In her latest book, Driven Out, Jean Felzer tells the little-known story of the tremendous violence and prejudice Chinese immigrants suffered after being drawn to the American West by the California Gold Rush. They were routinely rounded up, beaten, and even lynched by white vigilantes who stole their property and burned their homes. And when anti-Chinese sentiment reached a fever pitch in the 1890s, Congress voted to deport all of the 110,000 Chinese immigrants then living in the United States rather than offer them protection. The book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jean Felzer to my program today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sorry if I mispronounced your name. Is it P-F-A-E-L-Z-E-R?
Yeah, drop a lot of the vowels. It's Felzer.
Felzer. The Chinese weren't the only immigrants to come to the United States in the mid-1800s. Were they treated more harshly than the Irish, the Italians, the Germans, and the Russians?
Yes. One of the received versions of Chinese history is that it was, in fact, other immigrant groups that went after them. One of the things I found in Driven Out is that actually people crossed class lines to go after the Chinese. And in many small towns where these over 200 pogroms occurred, there was an alliance of judges, mayors, members of the county board of supervisors, timber barons, who worked with working class people to go after the Chinese.
Were the Chinese singled out because of their skin color? Because we're talking about, at least at the beginning, a time when slavery is still in effect and Native Americans are being driven from their homelands.
I think there are several explanations of what happened to the Chinese. Part of it is the racism of the period. What's happening to Native Americans becomes a template for the idea that we could have a mass removal of people, of an entire group of people.
Is this ethnic cleansing? I think what we call it, ethnic cleansing now?
I do believe it's ethnic cleansing. I know that's a very vexed and troubling term, but the intention was to drive out the Chinese at the local level from small towns, from rural towns, rural communities along the Pacific Northwest. The big picture was to get the Chinese out of the United States.
But you're talking on a local level. The Chinese immigrants were specifically prohibited by law from becoming U.S. citizens, weren't they?
They weren't allowed to be naturalized, and they were not allowed to testify in court. They weren't allowed to hold property. Many of the features that give an immigrant community a permanent foot in this country.
So had Congress specifically singled out Chinese immigrants with discriminatory laws?
Yes, two in particular. The most infamous one is the 1882 Exclusion Act. And that's the first act in American history to exclude an immigrant group by race. And the Chinese were not allowed to enter the country, particularly if they were laborers. Another interesting act of Congress was the Page Act of 75, which said that Chinese women weren't allowed to enter the country. That in itself is an act of ethnic cleansing, because if women can't come in, there won't be permanence, there won't be children, there won't be future generations. It's intended to kill off a population.
But some Chinese women did wind up coming to this country, mostly to serve as prostitutes or be slaves?
There were two groups of Chinese women who were allowed into the country. A tiny group of merchants' wives were allowed to come into the country. They were allowed in. The legislative language on this is very interesting. They were allowed to come into the country because their feet were bound. They wouldn't leave the house. They couldn't cause trouble. And bound feet were truly crippling. I met one Chinese historian who remembers her grandmother crawling because she truly could not walk. The other group, and the larger group of Chinese women who came into the country, were prostitutes. They were kidnapped from the port cities in Hong Kong and along the southwest coast of China.
Some of them were children when this happened.
Some were babies who came into the country to grow up into prostitution. And the prostitutes tended to live only 4 years. They died of brutality. They died of syphilis. I became very interested in the prostitutes who managed to run away to these small rural towns, because when they were rounded up and driven out, they were sent back to San Francisco, back to the Chinese men who owned them. So for them, the roundups were a particularly risky form of double jeopardy, because they were going back into slavery.
My guest is Jean Felser, professor of English, East Asian Studies, and American Studies at the University of Delaware, the author of 5 books, the most recent, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. It is published by Random House. You said that the lack of Chinese women made the Chinese settlements more vulnerable to persecution. Why would settlements with no women have been more vulnerable?
Well, there was a lack of permanence. There was an image that the Chinese were, quote, sojourners, and they were making all of this money off of American farmers, off of the mines, and sending it back to China. And by calling the Chinese sojourners, it's like the Bracero program or the guest worker program. People are temporary. And if they're temporary, they don't have legal status, and they're not seen as participants in community life.
Well, did they come to this country for different reasons than other immigrants?
They came for the exact same reason as other immigrants. They came voluntarily. They borrowed money, like my family's ancestors, my grandparents, and my father's family came. They borrowed money to come here. They were in debt when they came, but they weren't indentured.
But you say they were seen as sojourners. Is that because they continue to wear the pigtails, which would allow them to return to China, the queues?
I think they were seen as sojourners because they were Chinese, because they looked different. They had different food practices, different dress practices, different labor practices, and because they worked for less money.
Now, was it just the gold rush that led these Chinese laborers to move to the Pacific Northwest in significant numbers?
The gold rush was the first wave of Chinese Americans who came here. The second group of Chinese Americans who came here in large numbers, but they came and they kept coming and they kept coming, and they'd go home and come back. They were truly a transnational people, but the second wave came with the railroad.
And that's the one we were taught about in schools.
The only one we were taught about in schools. And when the railroad was finished and no recognition had been given to the Chinese at the time for their work on the railroads, they come down out of the mountains and they settle in rural towns. And in some towns, like Truckee, they become a third to a half of a population in a town that hadn't expected them.
They also start working at jobs that we associate with them. They get involved in selling produce. There are laundries. Some of the Chinese work as servants or work in hospitality industry, hotels and the like.
The Chinese enter the service sector, what we now call the service sector, very quickly, because starting almost as soon as the miners came here for the gold rush, they're driven out of the mines. Their tents are destroyed. White vigilantes ride through Chinese mining temp camps. Sometimes they had a brass band with them, and drive the Chinese off of the rivers. And so they enter the jobs that immigrants now take too.
Now, why were they driven out? Was it because the whites just wanted to eliminate the unwanted competition that the Chinese posed?
Part of it was what we were saying, the racism of the period. This is the time after the Civil War when the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment are really falling apart with the Jim Crow laws, the limits on the 14th Amendment. They try very hard to use these laws. They're the ones who find that in the 14th Amendment, it says it applies to persons and not applies to citizens. And they grab onto that and use it as much as they can. But this is a very racist period. The Southern Democrats, by the late 1870s, 1880s, have moved west. They've taken over the governor's mansion. They've got control of the state legislature, a lot of the county boards of supervisors, and they bring the black codes with them. So the Chinese can't testify, they can't vote, they can't own property. They have these bizarre cubic air laws about how many Chinese people can live in one room. And these are Southern ideas that are transported west.
But even earlier, in 1852, California instituted a tax on Chinese miners. They were the only miners who were taxed, weren't they?
No, the tax, the foreign miners tax, was actually designed for the first foreign miners who came, who were Mexicans, Chilenos, Argentinians. And after this backbreaking tax drives the Mexicans, Chilenos, Argentinians out of the Sierras, out of the gold country, then they apply the tax to the Chinese people. So there's a very strong racial link between what's happening to freed slaves and between Mexicans who had lived on this land for centuries. This land used to be Mexico. And what's happening to the Chinese. They don't need to invent this from scratch.
Although not all the Chinese were single miners. Some of them were working for Chinese companies, and they were a major source of income. You've learned that over 20 years, California collected $58 million from the Chinese miners. Some years, the tax made up fully half of California's revenues.
California made a tremendous amount of money, in part from the taxes on the Chinese people, and in part because the Chinese launch agriculture in the West. And without the Chinese labor, there wouldn't have been the vineyards, the orchards, the vegetables. When the Cross-Continental Railroad was built, the West was all dressed up with no place to go. There really wasn't anything to ship on the Transcontinental Railroad. And California agriculture, the invention of the refrigerator car, makes it possible to use the Transcontinental Railroad and economically connect the East and the West.
My guest is Jean Felzer, P-F-A-E-L-Z-E-R. Her latest book is Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. It's published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Jean Felzer, who is a professor of English, East Asian Studies, and American Studies at the University of Delaware. She's written five books, the most recent one, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans. It is published by Random House. And why don't Americans know more about this disturbing chapter in U.S. history? I mean, I have not seen it in I've seen some references to it, but nothing really in this kind of detail, and yet it is a very complicated story.
I thought about that a lot, and I was concerned that this would be a very hard story to find. In fact, the story was buried just under the surface. My first afternoon looking into the story, I was sitting in the Bancroft Library on the Berkeley campus, going through reels and reels of microfilm, looking for a story that I thought had happened in one town that I was going to just bring up to date. And as I sat there, going through town after town in the old Alta California newspaper, I thought, there goes Petaluma, there goes Santa Rosa, there goes San Jose, there goes Eureka, there goes Tacoma, there goes Seattle, that this story was all over the place. I think part of the story is hidden because it busts up a lot of stereotypes about Asian Americans. This isn't a victim story. The Chinese were formidably resistant. They filed the first lawsuits for reparations in the United States, as far as I can tell, lawsuits that would be followed by Jews suing Germany, by the Japanese, by the Maoris. Now there's a movement of African Americans demanding reparations. They were the first.
And the lawsuits were filed by merchants who were seeking reparations for possessions that they'd lost when they'd been driven out of their homes?
Not just merchants. A lot of them were very early forms of creative class action suits. And they were filed by workers, by women, by prostitutes, and merchants.
And they also formed unions and staged strikes, didn't they?
There was a huge strike in building the Transcontinental Railroad. And when they came down into these communities, they came not as individuals, but as a very tight community or groups of communities who had already figured out ways to protect themselves. And they did form unions. They had the Chinese Six Companies, which were merchant families that had formed to organize jobs and housing and legal protection. For a long time, they had China at their back. It took them a while to get China at their back because China didn't want to acknowledge that people would emigrate. Once they have China at their back, they have money, they have resources for lawyers, and they have the Chinese Six Companies.
Although some of these people did leave and they went to Cuba, they went to Mexico or Canada.
I think there's actually more people coming from Cuba and from Peru and Mexico, Chinese people coming into the United States. Yes, when things were really brutal, they fled when there was this vicious four-hour roundup in Tacoma, where the Chinese were marched out of town 9 miles in the rain, in the mud, and they're kept at a railroad crossing. Some of them catch boxcars to take the train to Portland. Some of them start the over 100-mile trek to march down to Portland, and a few do flee to Canada. But the Chinese who end up in Cuba, and particularly in Peru, to work on the plantations, many owned by the British, they were enslaved. And when they fled, they came to the East Coast of the United States. The Chinese on the East Coast have a different history, and they really get together in the 1890s when the law you mentioned, the photo identity card, gets passed, and it unites the Chinese across the country.
You've pointed out that the Chinese staged the largest action of mass civil disobedience that had ever occurred in this country in 1893 after California passed the Geary Act. What did the Geary Act require?
Congress passed the Geary Act. It was a federal act. And the Geary
Act... That was the ID cards that you were just talking about.
Yes. And the Geary Act required that every Chinese person bear on their body a photo identity card. And if they failed to register for these cards, they would be deported. It starts waves and waves of violence. For one thing, the Chinese really couldn't afford to deport. The United States couldn't really afford to deport 110,000 people. George Bush said last week, you know, we really can't afford to deport 12 million people. And they figured it would be about $1,000 per person to deport somebody in the 1890s. That was a lot of money. The country was destitute at this time. And the Chinese Six Families organized this resistance. And there were posters that went up on barns and gates and windows and the sides of buildings ordering the Chinese not to register. And out of the 110,000 Chinese, during the 1 year that they were supposed to register, only 3,000 people register for these cards, a tiny amount. Interestingly, of those 3,000, a lot were the prostitutes because their owners didn't want to jeopardize their property and have them deported.
And only a few actually were deported. I think it was 300 or something like that.
Very few were deported, although thousands remained in jail during the year after the expiration date to register happens.
Now, you mentioned the IDs. It reminds me of what happened in South Africa. We, even in this country, African-American slaves had been forced to keep ID papers with them at all times, the Chinese as well. There seem to be a lot of parallels between what happened then and what happened in the 20th century, more than we would like to think of, including, it seems to me, your final chapters could almost have been written about the immigration situation to some degree in the United States today.
Under the Patriot Act, there's a provision called Real ID. And Real ID requires that all of us, regardless of our racial background or our immigrant status, have on our driver's license by the year 2010 a great deal of information encoded, and it'll be encoded at our local DMV where we get our driver's license. It'll include our Social Security number, our travel history, our employment history, our personal data, and I hope that we have the courage that the Chinese had to refuse to go along with this, because should this pass, and there are a lot of efforts by groups like EPIC, which is involved with keeping our privacy, and the ACLU to fight this bill, but should it come into law, all of us will be very opened through the DMV. These are not people who are trained to process our most personal information and store it.
Well, California's entire agricultural system in the 19th century had come to depend on the labor of Chinese immigrants. It was extremely difficult for farmers to find U.S. citizens who were willing and able to work. And then the Chinese were pushed out. Now it's mostly Latin American immigrants who have come over and are doing that work.
I believe that a lot of the focus of the current immigration bill is on Latinos. It sets up the same second-class status that the Chinese had. There are towns now, like Hazleton, Pennsylvania, Riverside, New Jersey, Forest Branch, Texas, which have passed housing codes that say that a landlord is not allowed to rent to an undocumented worker. This is very much the same way to use a local code to drive an immigrant population out of town. And I think we should be keeping our eye on these towns because they are a modern form of ethnic cleansing.
My guest is Jean Felser. Her book, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, is published by Random House. One result of the Geary Act was that it seemed to legitimize violence against the Chinese. Can you tell us about the night raids in Redlands?
It was in Redlands, Fresno, San Bernardino. The whole southern part of California becomes swept up in this movement. The 1890s were a very poor time in this country. We were in the midst of a horrible depression, and thousands of whites and white men in particular had come west, leaving their families, hoping for a better life. And there just weren't jobs. A lot of towns are giving out food vouchers. As Chinese buildings are burned down, they make jobs washing the bricks or using the old lumber. And this is real New Deal, in some ways, make-work jobs. And at one point, one of the federal judges, a guy named Ross, allows citizens' arrests under the Geary Act. And it's a free-for-all. And vigilantes go into bunkhouses and Chinese tent camps and into the fields and demand to see people's identity cards. And even if they have them, they round them up and put them on forced marches and send them out of the fields so that they can at least have the agricultural jobs. And like in the Depression, people who didn't want that work did take some of it. It was a very ugly and brutal firestorm of racism across the West.
There were other Chinese farm workers who were shoved onto a boat in Butteville, Oregon. And in Santa Monica, they cleared the whole area of Chinese residents in just one day.
It happened very quickly. In Eureka, it takes 24 hours for the Chinese to be told to pack up whatever they can in one night, forced down to the docks and put on two boats down to San Francisco. In Tacoma, Washington, it takes 4 hours. Santa Monica, it takes a day. It was swift.
And where did these people go?
Most of them went to San Francisco. There was the image that there was the safety of Chinatown in San Francisco. And the San Francisco papers at the time talk about a serious refugee problem because there isn't the money in Chinatown to support thousands of people.
And, of course, now Chinatown is one of San Francisco's proudest areas. Perhaps even more disturbing than the Geary Act was an amendment to it that was proposed by James McCreary from Kentucky and signed by President Cleveland in May 1894. Can you tell us about that amendment?
The McCreary Act extended the Geary Act. The McCreary Amendment extended the Geary Act. And with it, it gave permission for people to go ahead and register for a longer period of time. And with the McCreary Act, it becomes very clear that Congress is going to support the Geary Act.
But also, a Chinese person is guilty until proven innocent, denied the right to bail, and to habeas corpus.
That's right. All of the provisions that the Chinese were claiming for themselves under U.S. law become explicitly denied to them under McCreary.
Were there any judges who were sympathetic to their cause because they brought so many lawsuits?
For a while, there was a judge named Lorenzo Sawyer, and he was known to accept thousands of habeas corpus acts and let Chinese into the country. And when he's doing mainly these thousands of immigration cases, his name pops up as favorable to the Chinese. But once the Chinese start to resist, for example, in the reparations case, Wing Hing v. the City of Eureka, which I believe is the first reparations case in the United States, then Sawyer backs down. And if you trace his life, he becomes increasingly racist and less supportive of the Chinese people.
And what happened in 1906 to end all of this?
It comes to a rather brutal end, but also a resistant end. In 1906, Humboldt County, which had publicly announced that they were free of Chinese people, which isn't 100% true, but the Chinese say, we are not leaving without our full season's pay. And there's actually bake sales and dances in this little town of Ferndale to pay for their passage and to pay off their contract. The salmon season had just started. Interestingly, they're rounded up and taken back to Eureka, and while they're waiting for ships, they're put on an island called Indian Island, and they're kept in boxcars, quite an iconic image for us. And Indian Island was the site of the massacre of the Wyot tribe in 1861. So the story ends with the Chinese in boxcars on Indian Island, the site of the massacre, waiting for the two ships, one of which was called the Roanoke, to take them away. And what they decide to do is go back to Oregon and work the season. So the photographs of this show a great deal of dignity and victory. But the image of the layered race of the Chinese being kept in boxcars at the site of the Wyot massacre is very compelling.
And were they, until immigration laws changed in the 60s, there were still more males than females in this country, but things did loosen up and Chinese were allowed to become American citizens.
The Chinese are not allowed back in this country until 1943. There are no Chinese allowed to enter the country legally until 1943. And this is at the time where we're at war with Japan, China's at war with Japan, and this was a sop to China to let the Chinese back into the country. My numbers are very low. I think between 100 and 200 Chinese actually enter the country in 1943. It isn't until much later that Chinese people return to the United States.
So this discrimination continued way into contemporary times.
Indeed.
Jean Felser will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Museum of the Chinese in the Americas. That's at 70 Mulberry Street. For more information or to reserve a seat, you can go to our showplace at WNYC.org. The book, Driven Out, The Forgotten War Against Chinese Americans, is published by Random House. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Tony Award winners Michael Cerveris and Donna Murphy on their new Broadway musical, Love Music, about Kurt Vile and Lotta Yelena. Also, the first Army interrogator to publicly denounce the military's tactics in Iraq tells his story of following orders to abuse prisoners at Abu Ghraib. Then, former Simpsons writer Larry Doyle, plus our latest underreported. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenda Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Stephen Valentino and contributing producer Virginia Doris. And Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.